Today, as The Guardian launches a major project on populism, we ask what Donald Trump's former chief strategist, the controversial figure Steve Bannon, is up to in Europe. And David Conn on the preparations for Qatar 2022, the most improbable World Cup yet. He was the man in charge of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, which resulted in one of the biggest political upsets in history.
I like Mr. Bannon. He's a friend of mine. He is not a racist, I can tell you that. He actually gets a very unfair press in that regard.
Then he was the chief strategist in the White House, where he had huge influence on the president's decisions.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
A year later, he was unceremoniously sacked. Now, Steve Bannon is in Europe. His mission is to bring Trump-style populism to the continent. And his first target is the EU elections next year.
The beating heart of the globalist project is in Brussels. If I drive the stake through the vampire, the whole thing will start to dissipate.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what is Steve Bannon doing in Europe?
I didn't have any personal interactions with him in the US, but Steve Bannon was omnipresent between around mid-2016 and now.
I love the word omnipresent. Is that actually a word?
I think it is. I hope it is, Anushka, because otherwise I've made a right fool out of myself.
Paul Lewis is an associate editor at The Guardian who's been leading a major project on populism that's launched this week. Previously, he was Washington correspondent.
He gave Trump a sort of ideological framework that he lacked. It was Steve Bannon that gave Trump the populist rhetoric that sort of made him pivot his campaign to try to appeal to some of the, if you like, the sort of the heartlands of America, the deindustrialized North. So Steve Bannon is widely regarded as having been a crucial figure in Trump's election to the White House. Bannon was also the voice on Trump's shoulder who was always sort of opting for the more polarizing, divisive, often somewhat negative approach to politics. You know, it was Bannon, reportedly, during the march on Charlottesville, who advised Trump to draw the false equivalence between the white supremacists and the anti-fascist protesters who turned up.
Unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
It was Bannon who reportedly, you know, was always agitating for those policies that were considered most Trumpian or most extreme, including the ban on Muslims as it was in its initial version.
And what's he doing in Europe?
Well, he says that he's here to try to foment a Trump-style populist revolt. Back in July, he unveiled this thing called The Movement, which he said would effectively be a political consultancy in all but name, and it would enlist political parties that are right-wing, populist, far-right parties across Europe and try and help them campaign ahead of the European parliamentary elections.
President Trump's former advisor Steve Bannon has announced plans to spark a right-wing revolution in Europe.
Ex-Präsidentenberater Steve Bannon has fédérer les droites radicales au niveau
européen avec l'objectif. We're talking about this out there, right-wing populist. How on earth, Paul Lewis, did you, from The Guardian, manage to get access?
I met him, first of all, in his hotel.
Hey guys, come on in.
Morning.
He always stays in luxury five-star hotels in London. His preferred residence is Brown's in Mayfair.
Man of the people.
Man of the people. And we sat there for sort of 2 hours talking about his project in Europe. And at that point, Bannon wanted me to write an exclusive, actually. The movement had not been launched, and he wanted The Guardian to have the scoop on him unveiling this big European ambition. And after looking into it, actually, I said no. It struck me that it was basically sort of hype and hubris, and the more responsible thing to do than sort of feed the Bannon bubble, if you like, was to decline the scoop and instead ask if I could spend the next few months with him travelling around Europe as he tried to enlist recruits for this project.
There'll be a six-month perfect body of work. I'm in. All right.
But he's a hugely controversial figure. When, you know, the New Yorker planned to have him on stage at a big event, the backlash was so fierce that people were dropping out. They had to pull him. You know, he's fallen from grace in the US. Why should we be reporting on him at all?
I think that's a really fair question. And, I think there's a big distinction to be made between the idea of giving Bannon a platform at a conference, you know, an ideas festival such as the one that The Economist or The New Yorker held, and giving him that elevated platform and legitimizing context. There's a big difference between that and reporting what he's doing. Given that we were launching a series into populism in Europe and elsewhere, and here was Trump's former strategist coming to Europe to try to foment a nationalist populist revolt, there's no way we could have just ignored that fact. So then the question comes, you know, if you're going to cover him, if you're going to try to sift the fact from the fiction, how do you do that?
So what's it like to follow Steve Bannon around?
It can be difficult. He's a very good politician. And by that, I mean, it is often said that he's manipulative. He can be very effective at twisting and turning and using smoke and mirrors to try to deflect or twist questions. He's really difficult to pin down. He has two modes. One of them, I would say, is very affable, charming, even complimentary.
It's not that it's. I'm quite fond of you, and you get so worked up.
I want to just understand.
But you get so worked up.
I don't think I'm worked up.
you get so worked up.
He's very good at sort of putting people at ease, complimenting them, making them feel that he's sort of within the fold. The subtext of that, when Bannon does that in your presence, it's sort of like he's saying, I am not this sinister figure who is involved in some of the ugliest far-right political movements in Europe and the United States. You know, don't believe that. I'm someone different. I don't do dog whistle politics. I don't do anti-Semitism. I'm a different type of political figure than the one you might think I am. And he almost sort of projects that image without even having to say it. It's just by adopting this sort of very friendly, affable style and demeanour. And I was always conscious, just sort of not to get seduced by that, to be honest. And the other mode, which people sometimes see on TV, is explosive.
There is something happening in European politics right now.
Is there now? Can I hold the press? Can I hold the press? Can I hold the press? Is there really?
It would be more.
Is there really?
Ask the question, and then you can respond.
Then I can mock and ridicule.
Which is there's no.
He can be extremely intimidating. He can be ferocious. He can be aggressive, and I think that combination makes him a difficult person to interview. And, you know, I have to say, some of it, I always get the sense that somewhere in there, there's a performative aspect, clearly. You know, Bannon is smart. I think he knows what plays well. I mean, we should never forget that Steve Bannon, you know, was a media executive. He ran Breitbart, the viral news website. He spent 10 years making basically propaganda films for the Tea Party. There was one moment when, you know, we really struggled to get Steve Bannon to agree to get out of his hotel.
Five-star hotel.
The problem with five-star hotels, if you're making a film, is it's quite a boring backdrop.
Yeah. You didn't get to, did you work with the guys in the Mussolini shot? You guys are so subtle at The Guardian. Can we just have you on the balcony?
Do you think that was the...
At one point when we asked if he would be open to standing on his balcony in Venice, and we would sort of film him from outside. And he said no, interestingly, because he thought it would make him look like Mussolini. You know, it hadn't even occurred to us that that would be what the sort of image of Bannon on a balcony would project. But he was two or three steps ahead of us and objected to the image that that would project. You know, your job is obviously to stick to your agenda, which is, you know, in this case, to find out what he was doing in Europe, try to sort the fact from the fiction and to hold him to account.
OK, well, let's talk about that then. What was he doing day to day as you followed him around?
So after launching this operation that he called The Movement, which was a Brussels-based foundation that he said would campaign for right-wing populist parties, Bannon had to find some right-wing populist parties that would sign up to this project. So basically, in the 4 months since, he's been travelling around Europe trying to enlist different political parties to join up.
And when you met him, he seemed to have this wingman by his side running things day to day. He was called Michael Madrikaman. Who on earth is he?
Yeah, so Michael Madrikaman is a strange character. He's a former corporate lawyer from Belgium who basically has, it's a sort of like a vanity party. It's his own party. He runs it with him and his wife. It's a far-right party in Belgium, in the Wallonia region.
Is it big?
It's tiny. You know, he doesn't have any MEPs. They're polling somewhere around 4 to 5% in Belgium. He's not a significant figure in Belgium.
Hello.
Hello, Mikhail.
Welcome, all team.
This is quite some place you have.
Thank you. This is the future HQ of the movement.
This is going to be mission control, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Indeed.
The headquarters of the movement is in Michael Madrikaman's home, and it's in the suburbs of Brussels. It's a very grand residence. Yeah, yeah, has electric gates opening up. Three or four large dogs.
My family can be with my dogs, even though they would drink the water of the flowers. This is Mrs. Clemmy.
Clemmy.
In the name of Churchill's wife.
So this dog's named after Churchill's wife.
Yes, exactly. Right. And this is Mrs. Thatcher. Also naming...
One of them was named after Margaret Thatcher.
What, the dog?
The dog.
What?
He has another dog named after Winston Churchill's wife. He's actually a huge Winston Churchill enthusiast.
This is an important place because it's here that I can gather people.
So this is a...
And this is a portrait I commissioned from Winston Churchill.
Of Winston
Churchill from
He clearly loved the idea of sort of emulating Churchill's style. He had a cigar room. He has an enormous, specially commissioned painting of Winston Churchill that hangs in the hallway of his residence underneath a chandelier. He even had a mock-up of him and Winston Churchill stood next to one another that had sort of been photoshopped in his office.
Oh, my goodness.
He would have been part of the movement. I have no doubt about this.
You think Churchill...
I would have made him an honorary member.
You think Churchill would have wanted to do business with Steve Bannon?
Yeah.
And are the pair of them having any success? Are the populist parties welcoming them?
In Italy, yes. For the rest of the continent, no. I mean, actually, it's really quite stunning. Bannon has succeeded in enlisting the support of Matteo Salvini in Italy. And that's not insignificant. You know, Salvini, as we know, is the interior minister in Italy. He dominates Italian politics. Outside of Italy, it's a mix of either ambivalence or the answer is, quite frankly, no from many of these right-wing parties. So Viktor Orban in Hungary and Marine Le Pen in France have both put out mixed signals about whether or not they want an American involved in their elections. And everywhere else, you know, the Sweden Democrats, the AfD, parties in Belgium, Czech Republic, Poland have all said no, they don't want Bannon's help.
What are the problems that Steve Bannon is coming across?
Well, one of the problems is he's American. He doesn't understand European politics. And lots of these parties that he wants to do business with are quite suspicious of receiving help from an outsider. I mean, the optics aren't particularly good if you're a party claiming to be a nationalist party and you're, you know, sort of receiving help from overseas. One example of this came when Bannon invited me to meet a woman called Giorgia Meloni, who is the leader of a far-right party called Brothers of Italy. You know, he had told me before we met her, I think rightly, that the party was post-fascist. You know, it has a political heritage that you can stretch back to the Mussolini era. You know, she rejected that flatly. Bannon claimed never to have remembered that he'd said that to me.
Steve, when you told me you were going to meet Giorgia, you described Brothers of Italy as a neo-fascist party.
I don't think I did at all. I don't think I did.
What do you say?
I don't remember saying that.
And then, you know, she sort of suggested that we, as outsiders, both Bannon and I, didn't really understand European politics.
Politics in Italy is a very difficult thing to understand, for us that we do that, for people they change always. Mm. So I understand that outside from the borders of Italy, if you both he's American, you're British, you both talk about Italian politics, you will talk about...
So being an outsider to Europe is actually proving to be an obstacle for him.
One of the suggestions I put to him that I think was a fair suggestion was that he was photobombing Italian politics, that he was utilising what's happening in Italian politics right now to elevate himself and, you know, sort of almost, you know, capture some of the limelight that was being shed on Matteo Salvini.
And he didn't like that?
No, he didn't like that. He didn't like that suggestion. He rejected that suggestion.
And one of your big findings was that actually a lot of this may be illegal. When did you start to discover that?
Yeah. So sometimes as journalists, you sort of come across little tips out of nowhere. And I was driving through the Belgian countryside with Michael Madrikaman. He wanted to take me to a place called Verviers, where he said that it was a town that had been subject to Islamization, in his words. And we were driving along, and he sort of just mentioned in passing, more or less. I mean, I was probing gently.
Yeah. So I would have loved to have a godfather, the movement godfather, but it won't be possible.
When you say godfather, like, what is that?
His own party in Belgium couldn't receive contributions from the movement. And that struck me as bizarre. I mean, Michael's party and the movement are both headquartered in the same building, his home, and his party couldn't receive contributions from the movement. The reason being, Belgium, like many European countries, has got quite strict campaign finance laws. And I guess that just sort of, I had a little sort of ping in my head, which was, well, if that's the case in Belgium, what's the law elsewhere in Europe?
And what about in like France or Italy and Germany? I guess you need a lawyer to find out.
Yeah, we'll have to see whether...
Yeah.
I asked Michael, you know, I was like, you know, what's the situation in France or Germany? And he sort of said, we'll see. And I said, you know, have you not looked into this? And he said something along the lines of he was so committed to try to enlist new members to the movement that he didn't sort of really have time to look into something as complicated as the electoral laws in each of these countries.
Everything would be open.
Yeah.
For me, right now, I'm focusing more on getting in the members, speaking to the members.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit frustrated because I have no time these last 2 weeks. I have no time next week because of my election.
Yeah.
So in recent weeks, Guardian correspondents across Europe have been given the unenviable and boring task of looking into the electoral laws in each of these countries. What Bannon said at the outset of all of this is that he would help right-wing populist parties campaign by giving them exclusive polling, data analytics, help with social media, even advice on their selection of candidates. And all of this stuff is basically a contribution in kind. You know, it's not a financial donation, but it has a financial value. It's the sort of thing a political consultancy would do. So you can't, in most cases, there are a few exceptions, but you can't just give this to a political party for free. It's breaching campaign finance laws.
So at the end of this, you've kind of concluded that he's perhaps not having as much influence as he might like, and that even he was photobombing Italian politics. Do you think it was right to cover him?
I did actually ask Bannon a couple of times what would happen if the media stopped covering him. And interestingly, those were the only times that he threatened to cut off access to me. Those were the only times he said, you know what, let's stop doing this. And that sort of gave me the impression that I was onto a fair point, really. He so relies on journalists sort of unflinchingly covering him all of the time that he really didn't like me asking that question.
This is where I think this sort of comes apart.
Okay.
What happens if the media stops reporting Steve Bannon?
By the way, the media, this is the question of the day.
For nine years,
and I want this is your last interview for The Guardian, because you're going to see. For 9 years, I didn't have one interview. I think I had one for Bloomberg for 9 years before I took over the Trump campaign. If you guys stop reporting tomorrow, we're going to do the exact same work and be just as successful.
Yes.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to start by cutting you guys out. Seriously. We're going to tell The Guardian we don't want any more coverage.
Mm-hmm.
No coverage.
Sure.
And we'll see you in May of 2019 and see what the results are.
No, stop. Because what happens to what you're trying
to do? No, I just said that.
There's an argument that you could say you don't have your cake and eat it. You're saying the media shouldn't give him undue attention, but here you are, Paul, giving Bannon this attention. You know, I think, again, it comes down to how you're covering him. You know, that's the important question, not whether sort of you do or you don't, because you have to. If you don't, then you're sort of sticking your head in the sand and pretending this thing doesn't exist. But the question is sort of how do you cover him? And the option that we chose was in as much depth as we can, in a way in which we are constantly holding him to account for what he's doing. So I think it's important that The Guardian's done what it's done.
Paul, thank you very much. You can read all of Paul's reporting for the new Populism series and watch his exclusive documentary on Steve Bannon at theguardian.com. After the break, is Qatar on track to fulfil its promise to deliver a seamless World Cup in 2022? Welcome back. It was seen as an almost unfeasible bid for a World Cup, hosted in newly built air-conditioned stadiums in the middle of a desert. But with 4 years to go, Qatar is full steam ahead for 2022. The Guardian's investigative sports reporter, David Conn, has spent a week in the country, looking into preparations.
Qatar won the right to host the World Cup in a famous FIFA vote, which was very controversial, in December 2010. They became the first country ever to host a World Cup whose team had never qualified for a World Cup. There was a big outcry at the time. There was a feeling that the only possible reason why a tiny country with very little football tradition could possibly be hosting the World Cup is because they're the richest country on earth. And that led to investigations into whether there'd been corruption. And as we know, many of those people who voted have since been indicted or found guilty or banned within FIFA for actual corruption. Qatar winning the right to host the World Cup has produced a huge amount of focus on the pay and conditions of the people who will actually build this massive construction project. Qatar had one stadium and they've commissioned seven completely new stadiums. But we were taken to three, and they do call them labour camps, and they were like really proud of all the facilities that they give these men now, and you know, it's clean, they have separate showers and toilets, they have food made for them that you can have in a canteen. And when we got to the canteen, I said, can I speak to some of the workers here? And they said, absolutely, you can speak to anybody. And it was four Ghanaian men. So, you know, from Ghana to Qatar, it's quite a journey. And then he told me they were being paid 650 riyals a month, Qatari riyals. And I thought, that can't just be what I'm working this out to be, £5 a day. But that's what it is. Although I'd felt that the people I'd spoken to in the camps hadn't been guarded, I needed to try and talk to people more freely than that. We just went down to a downtown area of Doha. It was very run down, and we were surrounded by a huge crowd very, very quickly. And they were basically stories of absolute despair and exploitation. These guys had come over, and they did actually describe themselves as freelancers. That is a word that they use. When they did work, the system of contractors and subcontractors and companies appearing and then folding meant that a lot of them had not been paid for work that they'd done on major construction projects in Qatar. And they don't eat. And in one of them told us that in a complete reversal of how it's meant to be, he was having to get money sent from his home in Bangladesh to keep him fed in Qatar. And that was shocking. On television, these new stadiums will look amazing and dazzling. One is in the circular shape of the traditional headdress that they wear. You can already picture the broadcasters having a wonderful time with these stadiums lit up, you know, for the purpose of showing off. This is the World Cup of inequality. It's the richest country in the world, hosting the World Cup because it's the richest country in the world. And then it's recruiting people from the poorest countries in the world on very low rates of pay and not very good conditions in labour camps to build the stadiums. And so I really hope that people will be conscious of all these issues even while they're enjoying the World Cup in 4 years' time, because if they're not, then it sends a signal to countries that bidding for these things as a kind of reputation building PR campaign really works.
That's all we have time for today. If you are enjoying Today in Focus, then please do subscribe. My thanks to Paul Lewis and David Conn. The producers for today's episode were Josh Kelly and Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.